Hello and welcome to the Niche Guarda YouTube podcast series powered by openmusiccouncil.org and citiesabc.com. The world is changing. There's more velocity and change than ever in history, but we are still humans. And as humans, we need to continue moving and we need to continue learning and we need to continue finding storytelling that actually creates focus, that actually creates narrative for all of us as humanity. That's the purpose of this series, and we are here again to continue profiling global leaders and personalities that actually can help us understand more about the world around us. In that order, I welcome to our series Dr. Yossi Sheffi, an academic, author, entrepreneur, and thought leader in engineered systems. Dr. Yossi Sheffi is the director of the MIT Center for Transportation and Logistics, CTL, and the Alicia Gray Second Professor, where he focuses on systems optimization, risk management, and supply chain operations. Dr. Sheffi has authored influential books on management, including The New Abnormal and The Shot in the Arms, and in his new book, The Magic Conveyor Belt, explores the future of supply chains and automation. With a life dedicated to the academia, Dr. Yossi Sheffi holds a bachelor degree from the Technion Israel Institute of Technology and a PhD from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, both in civil engineering. He has been involved in the MIT since 1975, and under Dr. Sheffi's guidance, the MIT CTL has launched pioneering programs. These include the MIT Master of Engineering in Logistics program, established in 1998, and the MIT X MicroMasters program in supply chain management, which has attracted over 1 million registrants since its inception in 2016. He has also consulted for governments, agencies, and global enterprises, combining academic enterprise with practical industry insights. As a researcher, he's the author of the textbook Urban Transportation Networks: Equilibrium Analysis with Mathematical Programming Methods, and 6 management books. His last book, The Magic Conveyor Belt: Supply Chains, AI, and the Future of Work, was published in April 2023, and the focus on global supply chains and the exploration of one of the most critical and complex systems of our modern economy, especially with the inception of AI and all the disruption of future and present of work. Yossi Sheffi is also a serial entrepreneur, having successfully founded and led 5 companies, including Logic Corp, PTCG, eChemicals, Logistics.com, and Synchro Systems. All of them were later acquired by larger organizations. Residing in Boston, Massachusetts, he continues to shape the field of logistics, supply chain, and engineering through his research, education, and industry collaborations. So, Dr. Yossi Sheffi, it's an honor to have you here. So, I'm very excited, but I've been you have a personality that is that touches a lot of different areas, from being, of course, in one of the top scientific research organizations, to as well being an author, being as well an entrepreneur. But one of the things I would like to do to talk to start, and I always like to go through the basis, is where did it come this energy to do so much different things and keep this rhythm on that level? Let's start with the basis. And I think that normally it starts when you are young, and sometimes, and I think especially in the AI time, this is even more important. So I'd like to start by that.
It's I don't know. I just maybe the feeling that in New York, in the Wall Street, when they work like mads, ask me why they work for so hard. I say because I feel that otherwise people are gaining on me and I have to stay ahead. So maybe I feel the same. But I also work in lots of different areas just because maybe I get bored easily from working in the same area. I like teaching, I like research. But I also like working with companies. I had lots of fun starting, 5 companies. I enjoy writing books. I got really big time into writing books after my last company. And after my last company, my wife said, it's either her or another company. That's it. So I decided that I look at the finances, and divorce was way too expensive. So I said, okay, enough. No, we've been married 54 years to the same woman. She you know, puts up with me, so everything is fine. No, but I work in many, and I enjoy all the parts of my work. So I like very much working with the company. I do consulting. I work with boards. I work with many CEOs. I like teaching. I like research, and I like writing. So I'm having a good time.
Wow, that's wonderful. So let's go back to, I still want a question about the basis. So you have as well background from Israel to the world. And of course, there's different cultures, different bases, and I'm sure your education probably had a weight on who you are. I don't know if you're not touched that, because I think it's more important than ever, especially someone that works with the MIT and is a teacher. It's of course, technology is changing who we are, but being human is more important than ever. And a lot of things is the IP. I would say that if you make a parallel between culture and IP, actually, like Yuval Noah Harari says, another Israel and author that I admire a lot, is that in the end of the day, each of our culture is an operating system. So how do you look at the operating system of your background, and as well who you are today as an author, as a professor, and as well as an entrepreneur?
That's some heavy questions, but it's, I appreciate it. Look, Israeli culture is different yet similar to American culture. It would have been much harder, let's say, to operate in Europe, in especially Southern Europe. Give you an example of what I mean. So I'm on the board of an organization in Spain, right? And in my first board meeting, there was the chairman of the board there. He was actually a minister of one of the communities, one of the independent communities. And I started by saying that it seems to me that our financial guy is not very good, and we should replace him. The chairman stopped the meeting immediately, stopped it, and said, okay, come to my office. I said, what happened? And he said, look, you don't understand. Here, when we do the board meeting, there's no argument. We just have a polite discussion. The real decisions are made beforehand. So you come to me the night before, we make the real decision, and then there's no way. It's very different. In Israel, you know, a board meeting in Israel, we fight like cats and dogs, but then we go and have beers together. It's not personal. I found out that it's not only Spain, in Europe in general, there's a lot of, making it look, okay, even when it's not, and a lot less direct. And people, and by the way, this is true in many parts of the United States as well, not in the startup, culture, but in big company culture, it's also the case that people don't like to, because people take notes. You know, board meetings are have the notes and have. So but I found out the difference. Israeli society is very much like Dutch society. I found out that Dutch people are very much like Israel. They're straight. They're not very, let's say, refined in this sense, but straight and don't go around the point. So I had to adjust. American culture is not like Israeli culture. I have to adjust. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So as my wife said, you can take the Israeli out of Israel, but you cannot take Israel out of the Israeli. So it's I try.
Well, you try very well. I appreciate that. I think these details, that's why I like these questions, is details are super important for business and for, yes, and as well for academic, because you can only
understanding different cultures is so important.
So as a global expert in engineering and as well director of the MIT Center for Transportation and Logistics, and that's why I want to come back to this, is this is even more important, and it brings us as well to your last book that I want to touch. But before that, so from this background that you just mentioned, and there's a lot of details, and this is a one-hour interview, which will be probably limited. So
it's okay. I can stay a few minutes later. It's okay.
I appreciate. So what is important for me to understand this? So we are in a time, and this I will ask big questions, and I'm sure you are more than prepared to answer them. That's normally my podcast is about that as well. But so the biggest challenge we have, and of course your book touches about that, but before I go to the book, I want to go back to this basic thing. So being on the MIT and the crossover, the most advanced technology platform, actually academic research, one of the top in the planet. But we have right now a lot of paradoxes in society. And this touches the different hats you have, academic, researcher, engineer, and technical expert in different areas, and then as an author, and then as an entrepreneur. So these four hats. So most of the people, and this is from my own experience as well as a technologist and an academic, and as an entrepreneur, is we have a very big paradox in our society. And I have a bit of Israel in blood from my father's side. But one of the things, if you look at history, okay, history is about storytelling, and then it's about logistics and transportations, because in the end of the day, you have the food in a city, and normally the cities are normally situated in a place where you can actually get very good logistics or very good infrastructure. But the challenge right now is that we are in a verge of society where we have firstly a very, very big velocity that never happened in history. And if you look at the history of humanity, we have like 40,000 years to just be the humans we are now. And in the last probably 10 years, we advanced more in terms of revolutions than in history of the last 40,000 years. And in the last 1 year alone, with AI and ChatGPT, we're going to advance more than probably. And the point right now is rewriting what it means to be human. But at the same time, we're not rewriting completely. So my question to you, and coming back to, and that gives me to the book afterwards, but I will explain to our others about your book, which I think everyone should read. But the question is, in terms of the definition of what it means to be human in this context of being an entrepreneur or being a business person or having a professional life and the engineering part. So there's a lot of things that are quite paradox right now, because no one knows what direction we are writing as we speak, a new iteration of what it means to be human. But from your experience and as well being behind the MIT Center for Transportation and Logistics, so, and I'll go to the question right now, is so we have this kind of on the business world, I will say there's a paradox between the digital and the non-digital. Okay, and what I mean by this is there's 400 million SMEs and micro SMEs, more or less, according to actually the World Bank statistics, although the statistics are not completely conclusive. And then all the studies suggest that 90% of the business have no digital knowledge. But then paradoxically, everyone has a phone, everyone is talking with everyone. So that means you have a computer in your hands, even if you don't know how to use it, or at least you don't use it for these different things. So, and now, of course, we have all these areas of AI and advanced technology. So the question is, how do you see this convergence and this paradox that the advanced technology, which you are, of course, member in one of the top institutes and organizations in the world, and the lack of digital, and the paradox how we are going to create this new iteration of what it means to work and what it means even to deal as humans. So it's a very philosophical question. I would like to touch this.
It's a very philosophical question, but I can describe a project that a colleague of mine, one of the researchers in the center, is working on. He's working in a certain part of Latin America. Failure rate of small and nano stores is about 10% a month. This is both a business problem and a social problem, because these are family businesses, you know, they fail. But we hooked up with the FEMSA, the largest distributor of Coca-Cola in Mexico City, in Bogota, and several other places. it's a problem. And they agreed it's a problem for them because they come to deliver and there's nobody there, or there's somebody else with whom they don't have a contract. So we are developed. We have a very large project involving 1,200 students from Monterey Tech, and we are developing apps basically on a phone to do a lot of the things that, look, these people were never going to use SAP or Oracle or anything like this, of course. And most of the consultants are suggesting that they, to be better, they should use all the advanced tech. This is idiotic. But as you say, the entry point that we have is the phone. And what we're doing, we're developing very sophisticated, very simple to use apps for inventory optimization, for ordering, when to order, how much to order, for all kind of elements of running a good supply chain in order to help them run their business and give them a dashboard with what's going on at every time. And all. Now, this is, we're just starting it, but it's exactly, we're trying to solve this problem of, which is a real problem, because the fear, or the big question is, will be the increasing inequality, that this small and me, in many parts of the world, these are most people are in this, these are, as I say, most of the businesses, not only most of the businesses are not digital. These are most of the businesses. They're small businesses. There are more small businesses than large businesses. And as I said, it is both a business issue and a social issue, because these are family, mostly family, small, people work with people they know. And when they lose it, it's a big deal. So it's too bad. So we're trying to solve this and trying to get these people at least to be sustainable economically. We talk about sustainability, usually talk about environmental sustainability, we talk about economic sustainability. So they'll be able to stay in business. We can go from 10% to 5%. These are millions of people that will be impacted. So we are, doing a very large project in this, but by and large, you're right. The problem is that the big company who can invest in the latest technology will become more and more efficient. And the fear is they'll drive the small businesses out of business. Now, it could be that in many places there's a role for government, that the government will have to support small business in some ways, through regulation, for example, through even things like minimum price, that the large company cannot charge less than a certain price so they can compete. However, after saying that, let me just say that there's also a lot to be said for, and there's advantage to small businesses that big businesses don't have. And the advantage to small businesses is what is, we come back to the question, is what humanity is all about. My wife, we can, Amazon here deliver in 2 hours in Boston, most of the time. Most of the time we don't buy on Amazon because we like to go to the store next door with a small bodega or try always to locally owned stores, because we know the owners. It's the whole process is more human and nice. So the process of buying, because an algorithm cannot replace the smile of the proprietor when you come to the store. How are you, Mrs. Sheffy? So there are things that AI, generative AI or technology or blockchain will never be able to do, or at least not in the foreseeable future. It's very hard to predict, 50 years from now, who knows? But in the foreseeable future, in the next 5, 10, even 20 years, it's hard to imagine AI replacing the strong traits of humans. So I think, I think the fear of both the business fear and the personal fear, people fear they'll be replaced by AI, is exaggerating and exaggerated. It's not going to happen that fast, if it happens at all. There will be changes. Sure, there will be new type of job, new industries and all this. But there's a lot of evidence. We can talk more about it, that the change is not going to be as quick as people think it's going to be. And we will have time to adjust, even though the world is moving faster. There's no doubt about it. But there are lots of things that make sure the world doesn't move too fast.
Yeah, that's an important thing. So I have a lot of questions on that, but let's go a bit for people knowing a bit more about you. So you are, of course, as my bio, and you will have the bio here for people listening to us, an academic, author, and entrepreneur, and the director of the MIT Center for Transportation Logistics, CTL, and the Elisha Gray Second Professor, where you focus on systems of optimization, risk management, and supply chain operations. And of course, you have the books we're going to be talking today, including The New Abnormal and A Shot in the Arms. And we're going to be talking today about the new book, The Magic Conveyor Belt, where you explore the future of supply chains and automation. So can you tell us a bit about the MIT Center for Transportation and Logistics, about your work and research and the career on this level?
Okay, the MIT Center is an interdepartmental center, so a faculty from all kind of departments of MIT. It has its permanent faculty, but project by project, we work with any part of MIT. The center has basically four main functions. It does research. The research is mostly funded by companies and by governments, of course, but I would say two-thirds or three-quarters, it changes all the time, funded by industry. It has education on multiple levels. It has its own master degree. It gives a master degree. It has PhDs. It's only graduate. Doesn't do undergraduate. Center, only departments at MIT do undergraduate education. Centers do not. And by the way, we don't think it should do. We think one should study engineering, economics, some of the basic disciplines. And then if one is interested, they can study supply chain management. So we talk about the research, about the education. We have we call external interactions. So we have over 50 companies who are members of the center, and we work a lot with them all the time on various ways. They work with our students, they hire our students, we do events with them, conferences, roundtables, whatever, on many topics, many, many times throughout the year. And we have the international dimension. So we have centers in that we set up in Colombia, Spain, Luxembourg, China, and Malaysia. And each one of these centers is like a copy of what we do, and then it starts developing on its own. So we help them hire faculty, get make sure that the students are of high quality and so forth. And they pay MIT for this. So these are basically the four parts of the center. In terms of my own research, I do a lot of operation research base. My background is basically operation research in terms of the methodology. But I work in urban transportation. That's my early work, was in urban transportation. Then I started working a lot on risk management and resilience. Then so I wrote books about that. I wrote books about the environmental sustainability, about supply chain environmental sustainability. I wrote books about the, you mentioned, during the pandemic, I wrote a book on the supply chain during the pandemic, and a year later, I wrote a book about the logistics of the vaccine distribution. So I work in many areas. As I said, I get bored easily.
Well, that's amazing. So let's talk about your books. If you want to just give a bit of an overview, of course, I think it's always better for people, and I have as well a series about Books ABC, which Actually, I'm going to do a couple of things about your books because I really love what you're doing. So I mentioned The New Abnormal, which is a great title, and The Shot in the Arm, which is another great one. And now you have The Magic Conveyor Belt. So can you tell us a bit the three books and then, of course, more of the last book? And I have a couple of questions, but just coming
Sure.
from you as the author, if you can summarize.
Sure. So The New Abnormal was written during the pandemic, and it was clear that, first of all, people start paying attention to supply chain suddenly. People realize that the stuff doesn't appear on the shelf, miraculously, but there are people involved, lots of organizations involved in getting product from the mines in China to a store shelf or to the Amazon warehouse into their home. So it was a revelation to lots of. So I wrote a book about the supply chain, what was going on, how it is going to impact supply chains, how it's going to impact business in general. Then this was in 2020, and in 2021, I wrote a book about the vaccine, which for me was fascinating because I got to talk to several Nobel laureates. Some of them did all the initial discoveries that led to the mRNA vaccine. And also Moderna, which is one of the developers, is, right behind my building. So it's right here in Cambridge. So I talked to a lot of people, and to me it was fascinating because I don't know biology and chemistry. It's not my, I know the minimum, but they're not my fields. Was fascinating for me to learn the process of making the vaccine, then the process of distributing and all this. And then the last book, The Magic Conveyor Belt, because after the pandemic, a lot of people started talking to me, started by telling me, oh, hey, supply chain, now we know there's supply chain. What is it? What's going on? I said, okay, I'll write a book about that. And I started writing, and then the describing supply chains in general for for people who don't know anything about supply chain. But then I started going to some of the technology involved, not just the process. And when I started describing the technology, exactly ChatGPT came out just as I was finishing writing. So I added stuff about AI and ChatGPT, but it was written concurrently, really, with it. I was trying ChatGPT a day after it came just to find out what's going on and how it works. So that's kind of the arc of the book. Started by describing supply chain, the technology involved, and the impact of AI on supply chain and workers in general.
So, and it's really all the books are must read. So let's go to the last one because it's the purpose and it's launched right now.
Sure.
So for people listening to us, and of course we'll put all the information, The Magic Conveyor Belt, Supply Chains, AI, and the Future of Work, which is, of course, it touches everything that is happening in our society. So on your preface, you touch a lot of different things from trends affecting supply chains, the role of technology in supply chains, and creating the workforce of the future. So I think one of the things I like the way you conclude the book is I'll speak, of course, I think people need to read it, but just some notes that I want to go in terms of this is supply chains, of course, run the world for good and for bad. If you stop some supply chains, probably AI will stop, especially the ships and even the computers or the cars that we use to drive and so forth. But supply chain is something that has been going well since there's humans, and there's actually society and cities were built. If you go to the Bible or even before the Bible, all ancient testaments and so forth, there's all the cities that we had from the Mesopotamia to the any empire was based on supply chains and the way we build it. So from your work and research and as well as a global expert in supply chain, how these supply chains are going to be affected? And I think one of the key elements of your book is how the digital technologies can be applied to the traditional supply chains, which until now have been mostly about boats and navigation and so forth, and now aerial and so forth, but as well now is digital supply chains. So I would like to touch this from a kind of historical perspective until the present perspective, if you could touch. I know
Of
that is a
course.
big question, but at least a bit of a
Yeah,
summary.
of course. So let's start with the fact that first of all, that supply chain has actually three flows. Let's talk about this. There's the flow of goods, there's the flow of money, and the flow of information. some of them can be digitized better than others. For example, the flow of money has been digitized. You know, when you have, I'm talking about advanced global supply chains. The flow of money has been digitized. The flow of information has been digitized. But one should not forget, however, that we will still need, for a while at least, the boats and the ships and the airplanes and the trucks to move physical stuff and deliver physical stuff. It could be that that in the future, the distances will be shorter for several reasons. First of all, people want to get control of important items. So the United States and the EU and South Korea and Japan are all invested in chip factory right now, for example, because they want to make sure that they are not dependent on China or Russia, on regimes that may be less friendly. There's also another reason, because of environmental sustainability. People think that regional supply chain will be more environmentally responsible. So, and then there's a third reason, this is total technology. We may get into what's called 3D printing, and we will be able to print devices locally, doing additive manufacturing. This is more in the future. This stuff has been, we always say it will be there in 5 years, but it looks like it will always be there in 5 years. But it is developing, jokes aside, it is developing. And we may get into a situation that you're not going to print a toaster at home, but there may be regional centers when you print items. So this will get some changes to supply chain. But it's hard to differentiate between the impact of technology and the impact of the politics, the impact of whether the politics is national security or sustainability or whatever. All of these are forces that operated all at the same time. So in terms of technology, technology makes, first of all, current supply chain, current structure much more efficient. For example, there now you can have visibility. You can. What's the difference? Let's go back a step. The difference between a supply chain manager and a manufacturing manager. The main difference is that if you are managing a manufacturing plant, you can go out and see what's going on. You can just see how the machines are working, where's the material, where are the workers. If you run a global supply chain, you cannot see it. You cannot go on the, you know, balcony and look around and see what's going on. It's all through messages on computers. So this is becoming a lot more relevant. Then a new generation of sensors, and some are still developing, that can follow a shipment from anywhere to anywhere and actually transmit its location and transmit a lot of other information. For example, if it's a cold storage, a cold container, it can tell if the temperature goes beyond a certain level and the food there may be ruined. It can also say if the doors of the containers were open and somebody tried to steal something. So it's a lot of information. So it gets to the point that managing supply chain becomes not quite the same, but more information is available. But that's to manage traditional supply chain. But at the end of the day, coming back to the issue of technology, supply chain are social structures in the sense that there are people on every side of a transaction. And to get a transaction, I cannot imagine, for example, that if you run an automotive plant or whatever in the United States, or you make toasters, whatever, and you buy some parts from a supplier in China or Vietnam or anywhere, that you'll just, there'll be an AI avatar that will talk to their AI avatar and create a deal. What still needs to happen is you have to fly there, you have to negotiate like crazy, and they have a nice dinner and talk about your family and get to know each other. Why? Because it is very important to get to know each other. So, for example, when there's a shortage and the world is becoming more and more volatile. Things are happening all the time. So you want to make sure that your supplier will send your company the stuff because they know you personally. And they know that you'll pay them on time and all of this. So creating trust is very important. And it's hard to imagine how AI, modern or otherwise, can create the trust that is needed to operate in all kind of environment and changing environment. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question. I don't even remember your question.
No, you answered. But your answer to the other question. The question was precisely this, how we look at these historical changes that we are facing, and as well, how the technology will play a role. So coming back to your book, because I have a couple of questions here. So when you look at the different iterations that are happening around these areas, is, of course, there's an entire part of, and your title touches about the supply chain, or subtitle supply chains, AI and the future of work. So, and you touch a bit this in the answer, but let's look on the concept of future of work. There's of course the arcane and vital supply chains to make the work, but the present iteration of what means to work is becoming very blurred. So if you can elaborate a bit on this,
sure.
Because that's a key element for us as humans as well, especially with AI.
Yeah. So let me first of all, the truth is, by the way, let me just say that nobody knows. There are people who think that it will be a total disaster and democracy will be ruined, humans will be controlled by machine. And people think it's the great brave new world and everybody will have more than everything that they need. So I think both of them are exaggerating. First of all, so people say, so what do you do when you don't know what the future is? Usually you look at history. In my book, I try to look at the various industrial revolutions. And every industrial revolution, fueled by technology, whether it's, from the British loom to the, steam power, to electricity, to the internet, every industrial revolution created more job than destroyed. And many of these jobs were new in industries that never existed before and job descriptions that never existed before. So in some sense, it's very hard to predict the future, but we know that in the past it always happened. And every time, by the way, people were worried and people were anxious and people were afraid. In many times in the past, it brought violence, whether it's, the British in the end of 1800 or the people who were striking against Ford and other companies in the US in 1930, and a lot of violence there. People were worried about jobs. On some recent court cases when people are worried about jobs. So, and every time people say, yeah, we know, but now it's different. So first of all, by and large, I don't think it's different. Now, historically, some jobs were eliminated. True. A few jobs were eliminated. Most of them, the vast majority of jobs were changed. Just the job had to be done differently. So, example, in academia, a lot of people are worried about ChatGPT. They can write student articles. Students are using ChatGPT and writing articles and all this. So some universities don't allow ChatGPT. My students, I tell them, you can use ChatGPT for whatever you want. Just be aware that it makes mistakes and sometimes invents stuff. It hallucinates. And by the way, when you submit a paper, I don't care how you write it. But if there's a mistake, you get an F, not Google, and not OpenAI. It's your responsibility. I look at ChatGPT just like we used to look, just like I looked at spreadsheets. Before spreadsheets, it was a huge task to create a financial model, for example, a very good financial model. Because you had to go to programmer and explain what you need and they didn't understand finance. Now the manager can do it on their own. So it's just a tool. So the question is, I try to get my students to use the tool intelligently, be able to get the maximum out of it, be able to monitor what it does. And by the way, talk about the future. One of the jobs that I for sure see in the future is monitoring. There will be a lot more automation and a lot more, you know, AI. And the question is, human will have to watch what's going on, and they will have to intervene if something is wrong. And this, again, is one of the big advantages of human. Human can detect if something is wrong, not because the machine is making a mistake. Something is changing in the world. And what the machine is doing, it doesn't understand the context. So now just, you know, Russia just invaded Ukraine. Oh, I have something that does, I don't know, that set up a payment to some. Well, but maybe now I'm seeing there may be inflation, there may be, you know, food shortages, who knows? Maybe the decision that the machine is trained to make are wrong. And the human need to be able to see, because they see the context, they see what's happening in the world. And this is a tough job. And it's a tough job for many reasons. For example, you know, airlines are today, the 777, 787, the you know, A350, all the modern Boeing and Airbus jets can fly on their own. They're basically drones, you know, they fly on their own. Yet there's always the question of acceptance. Would you go on an airplane with no pilots? Very few people will do it. Very few people. it's a problem. So there's a whole issue of when people are worried about jobs and what will happen. I said, it's not going to happen that quickly. Even though people think that everything is going fast, job change, society change are not happening quickly. One example, you know, one of the jobs that went away is telephone exchange operators, you know, operators that put the plugs in the telephone exchange when you call them. This job is gone. In 1892, AT&T invented the automatic telephone exchange. In 1950, there were still 350,000 operators in the United States. Only in 1980, the job went away. 90 years it took from the time of the invention until jobs really went away. So it doesn't happen so quickly. It doesn't happen so quickly because acceptance. People don't accept change so quickly. It doesn't happen because there are unions who fight many changes just because they're afraid of changing jobs and eliminating jobs. It doesn't happen quickly because of government regulation. For example, in Italy, it's a problem to use ChatGPT. I mean, in China is regulating AI very severely. And by the way, both the EU and the US have discussions about regulating AI, which means the minute that government start regulating it, which makes sense, you may have slow, it will slow the process down. Because government, before you come up with a new version of something, the government will have to review it. Just like they have to review when you come up with a new drug. They have to test it, they have to review it. In the United States, people are talking about a new, like the FDA, the Federal Drug Administration, there'll be a federal AI administration that will look at all these companies and say, okay, this works, this doesn't work, they'll test it. You cannot, it will be like medical innovation. You cannot release it before it's being tested. And you have a very precise regime on how to make the trials and the tests and then it being approved or not. Same thing may happen with AI. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that will be working to slow down the process. Let me just one more thing that makes me actually optimistic about the whole thing. And I compare what we see now to the early days of the internet. In the early days of the internet, and I'm old enough to have been there. I mean, we all thought that this is the greatest thing. People are gonna talk to their loved one, then we don't need to travel anymore. We talk to people. Nobody talked about identity theft and stealing data and terrorists talking to each other over the internet. We didn't see the downside at all. The good thing about the whole AI is that the industry itself is worried about the downside. And even today, already, even in ChatGPT, as it was released, they were putting what's called guardrails. So you can ask ChatGPT now how to build a Molotov cocktail. It will not give you an answer. You can ask lots of other, but there are certain code words that they already, in the, even without regulation, they already, the people developing are already realizing that could be used for bad ideas. So the industry itself is working and supporting regulation. So I'm optimistic. I also think that a lot of people call me about, oh, my job, I'm afraid for my job. I said, it's not. The one thing that you should always do is keep learning, don't freeze yourself in terms of knowledge. And it's easy today. You can take courses on YouTube, you can take courses on MOOCs, you can take courses online. It's very easy to upgrade yourself. So make sure you do it. That's all. Stay with it. Anyway, so that's a long answer to a short question.
No, it touched a lot of things there. So I want to touch two things, quite technical, but it's part of your book as well. And I think it's parts that I would like to touch. So one thing is, for instance, like you describe, quoting your book, at the end of the day, at the moment, we have automated warehouses with the size of 7 football fields that employ like 4 people. And the other thing is as well, the use of digital twins for supply chain and for all the areas of this. So I would like to elaborate, because it's one of the things at the moment when you speak about AI, we speak about this kind of monster that no one understands, or at least people that are not experts or in the industry like us get complex. And at the end of the day, it's just another Trojan horse that people are afraid. But when you start going to the nitty gritty of the details, that's where it comes, digital twins, metaverse, special computing, and a lot of these things that are making all this technology enable so much stuff. And like you mentioned before, if you look at COVID-19, still, if you compare, and it's a long question again, but the question is simple, but I want to go through the circle, is if you make a parallel between COVID-19 and the beginning of the 20th century with the Spanish flu killed around 200 million people, and at the time, the population of the world was around 2 billion or less. During COVID, we talk about much less deaths, and the population of the world was 7 billion. So effectively, there's a lot of positive stuff which you just mentioned that people forget it. But my question is really about this automation, especially when it comes to AI replacing big capacity of logistics, and as well the concept of digital twin that plays a big role on this.
Okay, so let's talk first of all about AI replacing people. The area where most automation is taking place in the logistics networks is in warehousing. People are putting robots in warehousing like there's no tomorrow. It was fueled by the it was going on for a while, but during COVID started going up because people didn't have workers, and now there's a worker shortage. So people are still putting a lot of robotics in the warehouse. At the same time, Amazon, which is very big on robotics, put between 2017 and 2023, 5-6 years, put a lot of robots in all the warehouses. They are totally automated. They also hired 1.2 million people in the warehouse. So what happens is, and I know that I wrote the book about the JD.com, and they have a warehouse which has almost no people, but they did it in one. All the other, it sounds to me like more of an experiment, because all the other warehouses have a combination of people, and actually they have more people than they ever had before. So I think we are moving towards a world where people will be there. The work will be somewhat different because the work will be augmented by machine. And let me give you an example of it. Some example where AI is already working and you don't even know it. When you call any customer service in a company, you don't talk to anybody. You talk to a chatbot. You talk to a machine. And they tell you, okay, you know, what do you do? Just tell me. It's not even press 1, 2, 3. Just tell me what you want and tell me. And what happens? You try to give it the answer, and sometimes it's fine. You get the answer. But if you don't get the answer and you keep asking, a human being will come on the phone. And that's exactly what we see. The simple stuff yeah, will be meant will be managed by AI or other automated system. And then the more complicated stuff, in some sense, the more interesting stuff will be managed by humans. So this happens in something like this, the dichotomy of simple stuff versus more complicated stuff is will happen in many areas, which raises a different problem. And the different problem is the people who answer the phone on ChatGPT, on the chatbot, after you the chatbot doesn't know the answer, are people with experience. They know how to deal with complicated problems. How do you hire people with 5, 10 years of experience? You cannot, because the people who come off school, university, don't have any experience at all, which in the book, I'm calling to changing the education system. We have to have a combined education, more like the German system of dual education, where people get at the same time they study in university, but at the same time work in companies and get real experience. Talking, I suggest for the United States to change it. The Germans are already doing this. So there are a lot of things that need to be changed. I also mentioned that there will be a period, if it will actually happen a lot faster than I think, there will be a period when government will need to step in and help people take time off to learn new trick. Big companies are doing it anyway. Big companies are already training people to work with new technology. The problem is what happens to small companies, which we mentioned before, and all the gig workers, independent workers. They have to take care of, for the most part, their own fate. Let me just move. We'll talk about the digital twins. Digital twin is, think about a simulation of, let's say, a jet engine. You have the jet engine, the physical jet engine, and you have the digital representation of the jet engine. This we always had before. It was called simulation. The difference now is that the jet engine sends continuous data to the digital twin. So the digital twin is always up to date. So when the aircraft goes to some dust in the sky or the number of landing, or whatever happens to the aircraft that influences the engine, data is being, there are lots of sensors in the engine that sends data to the digital twin. And just like everything else, we use digital twin all the time. We just don't call it this name. Let me give you example of the fact that you use digital twin and every one of the audience is using digital twin. When you use Google Map and you want to drive from A to B, from your house to work, whatever, what happens? You have the infrastructure, the real road, right? And on your phone, you have a digital twin. You have a digital representation of the road. And by the way, the road sends information always to the digital twin. So you have congestion, you have some road closure, whatever. There's information going on. If you use certain app, it even tells you where the police is and where the speed cameras are. So there's a lot of information sent from the physical infrastructure to the digital twin. We just don't call it by fancy names, so we don't think it's something. We just, and that's another thing. There are so much AI already in our life that we just get used to it. It's fine, you know, and we just use it. We don't think that this will, you know, kill our jobs. It will simplify a lot of things that we do, but in many cases, as I mentioned before, it creates more jobs. And one of the reasons, by the way, for all the anxiety that people are anxious about jobs and what will happen, is because we know the people who may lose their job. We know the people who work in the supermarket. We already see many supermarkets automating the checkout counter. You know, people check out themselves. Okay, so we think, oh my God, these people are going to lose their job. What we don't see is all the new jobs that will be created, because they have not been created yet. And no industries that will come out, they have not been created yet. So the anxiety is totally understandable, but yet we should realize that a lot of new stuff is in the process of being created, and it's not there yet, but it will come.
So this brings me to one of your papers, and I don't want to go too technical, but still, it's a very interesting paper that you launched recently. That is that you compare, well, paper and as well, it is based on your book, but as well, and one of the things that I wrote about the book, that you compare the future of AI, and you touched that in the past, but I want to go a bit more in terms of. You make a comparison with the future of AI and the present or the past events that happened with globalization. So let's make a parallel on this. And this, of course, is a forward question. So with globalization, we created de facto fantastic. If you look at the developing of humanity, we advanced more in the last 50 years than almost, like I mentioned before. But
No
as
doubt
well,
about
and as
it.
well, the
Absolutely.
life expand, and there's a lot of data about that, scientific data. But like you said, there's a perception, and the perception is the same with globalization, is that in the end of the day, we are all immigrants, but most of the people are obsessed about immigration. They're obsessed about now about the AI, and they will probably create what you see in science fiction. So the parallel that you mentioned about, just to finish, and I want to be on that, is the question is, the globalization created a lot of issues for the world economy and a lot of positive things. So on this part, and in the context of your book, how do you make the parallel between the globalization and as well the new iteration of supply chain and AI?
Okay, we made a mistake during globalization. There is no doubt that globalization made more people better off by a lot. Globalization was a net huge positive for humanity, but not all humanity, not everybody. The majority did great. They get, companies like Walmart and Carrefour made sure that items are relatively cheap and available, and Amazon gave you stuff online, became easy and inexpensive. And people had better standard of living. However, the big mistake was that we forgot about a minority that lost, minority that did not enjoy this increase because they were in a They lost jobs when manufacturing was leaving the United States and Europe and going to China. And nobody invested really in retraining and understanding their problems. This became, by the way, a political force. I think that's one of the main forces that caused Donald Trump to come to be president of the United States. But it's not only Donald Trump. It's you have movement like Donald Trump movement all over Europe in almost every country. You have parties. Some of them are, Marie Le Pen or in France, and others are not in the presidency, but they are not small. They're big parties, and they represent a large part of the population that's unhappy and feel that they lost. This was the globalization mistake. I hope we're not going to make this mistake with AI. And we started talking about it. We started talking about the fact that the governments need to step in, companies need to step in, universities need to step in to make sure that the small businesses, the micro businesses, the nano businesses are not going to lose in this. Like Amazon is driving retail out of business in many cases. We have to make sure that this, even if it has to happen, make sure the people don't suffer. So we make sure that we can move the people to a new profession. That's a huge task for governments. It's not clear how to do it. In the United States, it's particularly difficult because people don't believe in large government. It's a people are not the independent, the Western spirit, whatever you want to call it, it's just a different society. I can see governments in Europe and elsewhere more readily investing in people. The EU has what they call the Fifth Industrial Revolution. As a document, they talk about the Fifth Industrial Revolution when they talk about advanced technology, but talk about the human side of advanced technology as well as environmental sustainability. But most important for this is the human side. They said, we are not looking for tech to replace human, but for tech to augment the work of the of people. And this kind of the whole, that's what the EU is going to fund research into this. Companies are doing this. And that's, to me, that's the way. I don't see the US doing this anytime soon, but they should. But I hope when we see that how Europe is leading this, that the United States and other societies will follow and invest in people and the abilities to make sure that in education in particular, so society will remain, will keep functioning the way we like it. Anyway.
No, it's a very
hard
important
to predict everything.
No, thank you so much. I know that you have to go, so I appreciate it. It's a lot of things. So people, I will highlight the book in the description in the book and in the podcast. It's an honor to have you here. Thank you so much for your time and for this fantastic insights.
Thank you for having me, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.